This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is Branko Milanović, speaking with us today about the haves and the have-nots, the two classes into which human societies have been divided for as long as they've existed. In the news these days, Branko, we're constantly being told about the widening gulf between the nations of the rich and the nations of the poor. You say that income inequality is an old story, and in your new book, you draw on the proofs of history and literature, as well as on those of geography and economics. Do you want to begin with the Roman Empire, with Karl Marx, or the Gini coefficient?
Well, let's start with the Roman Empire, chronologically.
What was the degree of inequality between the rich and the poor in the Roman Empire?
You know, what was interesting about the Roman Empire, to the extent that we can really have good data, we do have reasonable data, is that on the one hand, we really have this image, which is true, that there were huge differences between, of course, the very top and the very bottom. And it's absolutely true. When you look at the incomes and wealth of the senators, for example, there were many times richer than today's senators in the U.S., who are already a pretty rich group of people, but the Roman senators were by order of magnitude richer. And of course, many people were living at the basically subsistence level. But it's also true, and that's actually the tricky part about inequality, is that many people were equally poor. So basically, you had a large percentage of population, maybe something like 70 or 80%, that were not very different in terms of their income because they were just equally poor. So that inequality measures really sort of go both ways. If you look top to bottom, you have this huge difference. But if you look at an overall inequality measure that measures everybody, then really a bunch of people have about same income and they're not that much different. And the result of that is that Roman Empire, if you use the Gini coefficient, which is one of the measures of most common measures of inequality, seems to have had the same level of inequality as the United States today. That's kind of a funny statistic.
Is there such a thing as good inequality and bad inequality?
Yes, definitely. I think there is such a thing as good and bad inequality. And as a friend of mine, Chico Ferreira, called it, it's like a good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. In other words, what is bad inequality to start with? The bad inequality is the inequality which essentially cements the position of the haves, so people who really maintain a monopoly on good jobs, on power, ability to go to good schools, and so on, because that perpetuates, obviously, inequality and rules out sort of possibilities to contribute about, let's suppose, half of the society. And then there is really good inequality, which is the inequality which leads people to take risks, to work harder, to study harder, and to try to do something with their lives. So you need that inequality, which is basically incentive-based inequality, in order to make society prosper. And for example, I have a vignette in a book which talks about socialism and asks the question whether socialism was egalitarian. And without going into great details about that, I would say yes, it was more equal than the alternative society that would have existed, but that extreme equality led to its actual demise because it did not provide incentives for people to work hard.
So some degree of inequality encourages economic growth.
Absolutely. I think so at an individual level and then when you sort of aggregate it also at a nationwide level.
Now, you divide your book into three parts: inequality among individuals in the same community or nation, inequality between nations and countries, inequality of income of individuals around the globe. Let's talk about within the nation or the community.
Well, within is the one inequality that we are most familiar with, and it's actually maybe politically the most important one, because that's the inequality within each nation state. Obviously, for the Americans, which counts the most, and what we read in the press like practically every day nowadays, is inequality within the United States. And as we know, inequality here has become greater. I'm not using the word that often people do, worse, because it implies a judgment. But really, the fact is simply that it has become greater now than it was 20 years ago. And then, of course, there are different explanations, and there are also some problems with that, the fact that, of course, the top 1% has really accumulated lots of gains of growth, and maybe 90 or 99% of the people did not see much effect from that. So that's the most common one. And that particular trend of rising inequality within nations is not something which is unique to the United States. As we know, it has increased even more so in China, it has increased in Russia, it has gone up in India, and it has gone up in the UK or even in countries that are really quite egalitarian. And still they are actually quite egalitarian, but they are less egalitarian now than they were in 1978 or 1980, like Sweden. So it is really kind of a worldwide trend that we have observed.
In terms of American history, go back to the end of the 18th century, and then what was the level of equality of income over, let's say, the last 200 years?
Well, for the U.S., we have actually, I think, fairly good data for about like 150 years or so. And basically, U.S. inequality has been on the rise in from around, let's suppose, 1850 to 1920. And again, this is not something very unique. It has been also on the rise during the early industrialization period in the Netherlands or in England or even in France, although we have less sort of reliable data. And then it reached a peak. It is often said it just reached the peak before the Great Depression or thereabouts. And afterwards, particularly with the Great Depression and with the war and with the introduction of social security and welfare programs under the New Deal and afterwards, and you know, with the continuation of the Roosevelt administration, it actually started its long-term decline. So it reached its minimum around late 70s. But put it in the Carter era, that was the minimum. I'm not ascribing that to the presidency, just saying chronologically that's what happened. And then it started an increase, and it is now, it's not back now in the 1920s, but it is significantly higher than it was in the late 70s. So basically we have, just to sort of conclude, we have had a period of a long-term increase, then a period of a long-term decline, and now we have a period of two decades of growth or stagnation at the high levels.
Plato thought that income inequality was an evil that should be guarded against. Do you have that same feeling, or do we see that proof in the history of economies over the last few thousand years?
Well, I don't have the same opinion, but of course it is worth quoting Plato. Plato, as we know, had a very sort of extreme conception of an autarkic society, a society which would not trade or communicate with others, and which would really enforce essentially a huge level of equality. But that equality would not hold for the so-called guardians, which meant really people who were in power. So he had, I think, an extreme point of view. However, he is right that in a sense that when inequality becomes huge, and that was going back to the question about like bad inequality, the society really splits into two. And Plato argued, and I think it's a good argument, that if a society splits into two, then of course it's more easily conquerable. His point of view was that actually if you have two nations and one is basically split between rich and the poor, the other nation that is not split like that can actually use either the poor or the rich to further its own objectives.
To support the notion of benevolent inequality, you quote both Max Weber and John Maynard Keynes. What they say, it seems to me, is applicable to the great American philanthropists of the late 19th century. Perhaps you can develop that notion.
Yes, that's very true. Actually, both Keynes and Weber, of course, in his Spirit of Protestantism and Keynes in the, I think, Economic Consequences of the Peace, said that what was the social agreement, implicit social contract, rather, in the 19th century and early 20th century, was that the rich indeed can become rich, but they should not consume all their income or wealth. They should not consume it so that other people don't get envious because they display all that wealth. And secondly, they should use that wealth to, you know, help others and, you know, do philanthropic things and so on. So in other words, acquisition of wealth was seen as necessary in order to fuel the engine of economic growth. But it was seen as unseemly to show that you have become so wealthy. So they both say it was a very unique situation in history that the rich do really get richer, but they are able to abstain from showing that wealth. And it's kind of hard for people to do that.
And usually if the very wealthy make too much of a display of themselves, it leads to political unrest and trouble within the society.
I believe so. I actually think that the current events, in particular in Tunisia and Egypt, and Bahrain, and I'm not sure about Libya because it's a very different case. But certainly I would argue for Tunisia and Egypt that the turmoil was to a large extent, in my opinion, driven precisely by that open display of wealth or open disregard for certain rules, where basically a small elite, which was all interconnected, not only became rich, but really showed by its pattern of life to be different from others. And people don't like that. They resent it.
One of your vignettes is chapter, you have a title about your income is decided, has more to do with where you're born than anything else. And maybe you can explain that and explain what you mean by the 80-20 law.
This was quite interesting because today, global inequality, if you look at inequality between all individuals in the world, is such that the major driver of that global inequality are differences in average income between countries, in average incomes between countries. So we have really rich U.S. versus relatively poor Mexico, rich Spain versus poor Morocco, and so forth. And then when you actually look at incomes of people, and try to explain why certain people are, globally speaking, rich or in the middle class or poor and so on, you find that you can explain almost 60% of their income by the fact where they were born. In other words, people who tend to be born in rich countries, let's say, suppose you are born in Denmark. Now, even if you happen to be very poor within Denmark, you will be very rich globally. So it's a very special situation that we are now facing in the world where lots of your global position depends on where you were born and whose citizen you are, because that entitles you obviously to higher incomes and a very long stream of other social transfers and benefits and so on. Now, 80-20 world refers to the fact that in many phenomena, including economics, like you have 80% of the phenomena being essentially captured by 20% of people. In other words, like 80% of global income being captured by 20% of the people in the world. For income distribution, it is even worse because it's really the very top captures even more than 80%. So it is a very unequal world.
The 60% that has to do with where you were born, right, in a rich country or a poor country, and also in terms of the income level of your parents.
Right. There is a second element there, and that's why I think it's very important to sort of realize that basically lots of your income may be determined when you were born, because as I said before, 60% may be due to the country where you're born, and then 20% may be due to the income status of your parents. So in other words, imagine the world such that at any moment when a baby is born, you have a fairy. The fairy has two big balls in front of her, and then she, the fairy being a female, I suppose, pulls out two pieces of paper. On one piece of paper, it says what country you're born, and that would determine 60% of your global income position. In the other piece of paper, the fairy pulls out another piece of paper, and that piece of paper says you're born in a rich or poor family, and that determines for the 20%. So in that sense, really lots of our fate, if you will, is determined at the time when we are born.
That doesn't leave much room for effort and the mobility upward.
Unfortunately, that's the situation now. Now, it could also change because what is happening with increasing incomes in China, India, and Brazil, and so on, is that the differences between mean incomes between countries would be reduced. As these differences are being reduced, that first element of 60%, which comes from the from where we are born, would be lessened. So in other words, if we move to a world where really the differences between countries would be relatively small, then the 60% would gradually go maybe to 50, 40, and so forth. So things are changing. However, if you just look at the fact now, you really don't have much room for effort and luck, globally speaking. And that means that the migration becomes a very important element of people trying to raise their incomes by essentially becoming somebody else, which means citizen of a richer country.
So we can envision the world being divided into gated communities?
That would be an unfortunate development. You know, the world now is at a very, I think, delicate stage, because if the good trends in the third world and the emerging markets continue, then the world would become much more unified. And as I said before, the 60%, which depends on where you're born, would be reduced. And there would be really much less need to create gated communities. On the other hand, if the world does not become more similar in terms of income, average income, then the rich world will really have to gate itself against all these masses of the poor people. So my point there is that it is really in the interest of the rich world that the emerging markets, and particularly poorer countries like Africa, be success cases.
Bronco, you are an historian, but you are also the lead economist for the research division of the World Bank. So you have a command of calculations and numbers that most people do not. How do we measure income inequality, and what is meant by the Gini coefficient that you use from time to time in your book?
Well, very good question, Lois. It is actually we economists, in particular those who work with income distribution, we kind of forget that we need to explain sometimes what are our tools. Our most common concept of inequality, and I have to underline it's a measure of inequality, which means that that measure goes up when people become more unequal. And that measure is the Gini coefficient. And it goes from zero when everybody has the same income, which is a theoretical possibility, doesn't exist anywhere in the world, or the maximum is 100, where one person grabs the entire income of the country. Well, that doesn't exist in any country in the world either. Even if Gaddafi is very rich, he has not taken the entire income of Libya. So the in the real world, the numbers range between 30 to 60. That's the range of the real world, with the U.S. being on the upper range of the rich world. The U.S. is about 43. China is about 45. Russia is about 45. And Brazil is at 55. And now the world itself is really, of course, more unequal than any individual country, and the world is at 70.
So the higher your Gini coefficient, the more the income inequality. Is that correct?
That's absolutely true, yeah. The higher the Gini coefficient, the higher income inequality in your country.
Another measure that you use is Adam Smith's in terms of wealth being the amount of labor you can command.
Yes, that's an interesting measure. It's actually Adam Smith was the first one to mention that. He said, well, look, how are we going to measure wealth of people over time? He said, we really cannot do it by gold because price of gold varies from place and from time to time, and it's not really the ultimate purchasing yardstick to use. We can do it better, he said, with corn because corn is needed for subsistence, so the value of corn should be actually more stable. But he said the best way to measure it, we should measure it by how many people a rich man can employ with his own income. And this is what I do in my sort of small vignette, which looks at who was the richest person in the world. And it turns out that the person who could actually, at his own time, hire the most people with his income was John D. Rockefeller, who could actually hire quite a few more Americans of his age than any other rich person before or after.
Richer than the Roman Emperor Augustus or Kublai Khan.
I left out of the study the emperors and the ruling monarchs because for them it's very difficult to distinguish between their own private wealth and the wealth of the country or basically the state budget. But for private individuals, for instance, I used Pallas and Crassus from Roman Empire, or people like Rockefeller or Bill Gates or Andrew Carnegie, it's easier to actually say what is their own private wealth.
You have a vignette about where Marx went wrong. Tell us about where Marx went wrong and how it impinges upon the question of inequality.
I'm glad you asked that because I think it's a very crucial part of the story. When Marx wrote Das Kapital, he spoke a lot about proletarian solidarity, essentially meaning that workers in most countries of the world have the same interest, which meant essentially to overthrow capitalists. Now, if you look at global income inequality at that time, which of course he didn't have this data, but you know we now can reconstruct that.
You're talking 1867.
1867, exactly, when Das Kapital was published. It turns out that the largest determinant of global inequality at the time was indeed class. In other words, it was really whether you were born or whether your position in your country was low or high. And that meant that if you were at the low position, you were worker or peasant, you actually had quite a similar income whether you were in in England or France or the US or Russia or even China. But now the situation is entirely different. Now, if you're really, as I said before, if you're really a poor person in Denmark, your income will be many times higher than a poor person's income in Tanzania or the Philippines or Bangladesh. So then really you cannot speak any longer of this proletarian solidarity simply because the material conditions of the people are entirely different. So whereas in the past, class was the major determinant of your global income position, today it's location. And that's why I think we have really gone to a world which is now very different from the world that was in 1867 or 1870, where really class was the determinant factor of your position in the world.
Thank you, Branko Milanovic, for speaking with us today about the haves and the have-nots. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.